Went down to the river, washed my sins away. Praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man.
Welcome back to another episode of Ars Politica Podcast. This is Stephen Wolf. Thank you for listening. So today I want to talk about a couple of things. One is going to be something I've answered several times on different podcasts and in different places. And that is why the term Christian nationalism. Some of you who listen to this regularly or listen to me on podcasts have heard me answer this, but I figure I'd answer that one more time. Why not for this podcast? The other one would be the issue of the political. Doug Wilson just Tucker Carlson released his interview with Doug Wilson, and it was a very good interview. I have not listened to all of it, but I did want to address one issue that I think that he and I might disagree on. Maybe it's just a rhetorical thing. Maybe it's an audience thing. I don't know, but I'll talk about it a little bit, and I'd love to talk to him about it as well someday. So the first thing is, like, why Christian nationalism? Why the term? So the story kind of goes back to 2020. I got on Twitter, I think it was 2019, maybe. I joined Twitter. It wasn't very active at the time. I was trying to figure it out. I remember it was kind of clumsy and didn't really know how to do it. I remember I used to do a lot of satire on Facebook. And I did some satire on Twitter early on, and it completely didn't work. It didn't work at all. And I, even to this day, I see screenshots of people thinking I was serious. And Ukraine, Russian war. I don't know what it was, but I wasn't very good at it. Anyway, in 2020, I start seeing this discussion about Christian nationalism. I had not identified with the term very much at all. And I recall seeing the term, and there's this conservative tendency to see what the left is throwing at you, what the terminology they're using at you. So it could be racism or xenophobic or nativism or, you know, nativist, all sorts of things, homophobic. And the conservative has this, the mind to respond and deny. That's the conservative MO. I mean, basically what they do when the left hurls something at you is you instinctively by habit say, I'm not that. I'm not a nativist or a xenophobe. I'm not homophobic or transphobic. You see this all the time. I mean, you read a book by an evangelical about disagreeing with trans people, transgender or whatever, and they have to spend half the time explaining why they are not actually transphobic. It's just a conservative habit. It needs to be exercised from the mind, mental control, that mental block that we have in our mind needs to be expunged, eradicated. And first, you need to be self-aware of it. Part of the way, the one reason why I don't call myself a conservative is that it's a process of unlearning the habits of the mind that you were basically learned from your own conservative commentators. Like, the worst thing you could be is a fascist and be called a fascist. And so you want to be, in a way, anti-fascist without being Antifa. And everything has to go back to being about World War II and the Holocaust and Neville Chamberlain and appeasing Hitler. So I remember back 20 years ago, you'd hear people like Sean Hannity constantly talk about how Saddam Hussein was basically the new Hitler and how we're going to appease him and this and that. Everything had to go back to World War II. Anyway, I don't know how I got into that, but in 2020, I started seeing the term Christian nationalist running a term thrown around. And I just started thinking, like, wait a second, I don't have any problem with the nationalist label. Partly because I just don't really care what people think about me. I don't care if I use terminology and then people's own mental, almost like mental insanity. Like, their first thought is Hitler. When I say nationalism, well, that's your problem. It's not my problem. And so, and that's how I approach most terms. It's like when people call me a fascist, it's like, well, okay, I've read fascist literature. I've read about it. I don't affirm a lot of what they affirm. So, I'm not a fascist. I don't have this instinctive, I don't believe in those connotations. I'm not that. How dare you? I don't have that kind of mental proclivity to respond in that way. So I see the term nationalist or nationalism. I don't have a big problem with it. At this point in my life, I had not really, I guess, identified with a sort of movement label. And so anyway, it wasn't like I was switching. I was basically switching from being a Christian conservative to being something. But anyway, I didn't have a problem with the term nationalism. And then I thought, well, I'm a Christian. So what's wrong with Christian nationalism? Like what is wrong with that terminology? Is it something that we could take and say, yeah, I mean, we're Christian and we're nationalists. We love America. We want America to do well and be good. And we think that involves the various institutions and powers that God has ordained. So that's nationalism. I think there's a way of life. There's an American way of life. It's not simply a universalist conception. It's not simply for everyone. There's actually a uniquely American way of life among its variety of different regions and locales. I am a nationalist in that regard. So what's wrong with Christian nationalism? And I started thinking about that. I started thinking about how you would relate Christian to nationalism and make it a coherent concept. So in terms of political theory, at this time, I was finishing up the dissertation. I was about to defend my dissertation from LSU, and I had read a lot of Puritans. I had read a lot of New England Puritans in particular, and how it related to the American founding. So I had read a lot of theology. That's kind of, in part, that's my background in theology. I was responding to claims about the American founding and New England Puritanism in my dissertation, largely written by Roman Catholics and Jews, which you'll find if you study among the general conservative crowd, the people who write on the American founding era are often Roman Catholics and Jews. And what this means is that they usually don't know what they're talking about with regard to Protestantism. So they think Protestantism is theonomy or Reconstructionism is anti-natural law, it's anti-natural theology. They believe this because, I mean, in part because Protestants were saying this for a long time in the 20th century. And even to this day, I have to deal with this like every single day, where people essentially think that Calvinism or Reformed theology is reflected in 20th century theonomic and Reconstructionist thought. But it's not. But anyway, my dissertation was addressing those claims and then trying to understand the American founding in light of classical Protestant theology. That's pretty much my dissertation. I'm not encouraging you to read my dissertation because I don't want you to. But someday, perhaps I'll get it published once I clean it up and make it smart. Anyway, I passed a finished dissertation. What is it? What's the term? A good dissertation is a finished dissertation until someone reads it and wants to call you an idiot, I guess. But anyway, that was 2020. And I had that background thinking through Christian theology and how that would apply to politics. And I used a lot of that, my thinking on that, in my book, The Case for Christian Nationalism. But what happened was I was sitting outside. It was a nice like spring day, as I recall. And I was outside on my patio, and I was smoking the pipe. I forget what else. I was just sitting out there, probably enjoying the nice spring day. And I randomly thought, you know, I should tweet this. I should tweet out, what would you all think if I wrote a book on defending Christian nationalism, in defense of Christian nationalism? And then I get a message later from Canon saying, hey, send a proposal in. So that's how it all kind of began. I don't know if I actually outwardly by that point had claimed the label, partly because I didn't see it as a movement. And I initially didn't expect it would become a movement. I guess I wasn't sure. I don't recall exactly, but I saw it as a term that would become that a term that I could explain and explicate in terms of political, like Christian political theory. Of course, like anyone who writes a book on politics, they hope that it would convince people and spark some kind of movement. So I was interested in that. And I think by the end of the book, I started seeing that, no, there were people kind of rallying around the term. And so by the end of the book, I did, writing the book, I did have this sense that it was more than just a political theory term. But for the most part, as I was writing the book, I was writing it as a work of Christian political theory, really not knowing where it would go, where it would take, what sort of following or influence it would have. I kind of assumed, I remember telling my friends before it came out, I said, yeah, I think it'll make a splash. I think because people will see that a conservative Presbyterian who has a PhD wrote a book defending Christian nationalism. And so I think there's going to be people who are going to say, wow, look at this. And there's going to be a lot of haters and there's going to be some negative reviews in different places. I did not know that a year and a half later, you would still have people, internet, like people from non-Americans writing reviews and denouncing it and saying, calling it dangerous and this and that. I did not expect that. And it's every writer's dream to be still talked about for so long afterwards. But I guess, yeah, I mean, at first, again, when I started writing the book, I didn't see it as a kind of movement. But you can tell if you read the epilogue, I was conscious of a growing movement and the possibility of a movement at the time. So, but yeah, I mean, ultimately, I guess what it comes down to is I said Christian nationalism, like the two terms, and how can I explain this? And the background of it is largely paleoconservatism. So I moved away about 10, 15 years back. Around 2010, I started transitioning kind of from a neoconservative outlook where I have to say when I was 17, 18 years old, I was kind of pro George Bush. I did have in the back of my mind concerns about the Iraq War, mainly because I also had respect for Patrick Buchanan, who was against it. But then at the same time, I was caught up in that kind of, I was also a new Christian, and you see George Bush as like this Christian leader. And of course, I was in like a quasi-dispensationalist church, so there was like this pro-Israel thing going on. And I moved out of that around after I got married, and around 2009, 2010, and started reading a lot more paleoconservatives. Now, at the time, you read paleoconservatives, and they're mainly Roman Catholics. And a lot of them, in the American context, are kind of anti-New England, anti-North. A lot of them are from the South, or if they're not from they might be from the North, but they've kind of moved and drifted and aligned more with kind of Southern conservative mentalities. And they were very critical of the Puritans. And then I'm reading Roger Scruton, who has a few like one-liners against Puritans and Calvinists. And I'm starting thinking, boy, I mean, is it true that all the reformers were all nominalists and occamists, and they didn't believe in natural law and theology, and they had all these things, and they were universalists in terms of politics. And that actually made me think, wait, no, there needs to be, I remember early on, maybe 2015, 2016, I actually said something on Facebook to the effect of, someday I'm going to write a paleoconservative argument or a paleoconservative justification of, or a Protestant, how do I say this, a Protestant political theory that assumes paleoconservatism, that's something like that. And so if you pick up The Case for Christian Nationalism, that book is, you know, I don't think I state that. I actually probably forgot about that thing I said years ago. But I don't state it directly, but that's basically what the background of the book is my paleoconservatism and my Protestantism trying to bring them together. And through the process of doing that, I discovered the retrieval projects that would go back to the 16th and 17th century. And that's where I was able to connect the dots and in principle, and with good principle, affirm that you can be a paleoconservative, mainly someone who emphasizes particularity, regional identity, those sorts of things, and also be a good Protestant at the same time. And I think they're perfectly coherent and consistent. And in fact, I think Protestants, in terms of nationalism, Protestantism fits better with that sort of thinking than I think Roman Catholicism, which can easily become very internationalist. And I don't want to get into this too much, but of course, there's an issue of the Pope being a sort of foreign power. But anyway, and I mean, you can see from the integralists, some of the integralists, the Roman Catholic integralists, they do have this kind of church first mentality that can easily override the demands of a coherent nation of solidarity. But I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. I've already gone down a few rabbit holes, but that's kind of the origin of adopting the label. And I really haven't changed even since the book came out after all the criticism. I still like my definition, my technical one and my less technical one. And I think it captures basically what I'm trying to communicate. So that's kind of the origin story of the term Christian nationalism, why I adopted it. Probably there's something else that I could mention, but that's about it. The other thing is, so Doug Wilson was interviewed by Tucker Carlson. It was a great interview. I haven't listened to all of it, but he said at one point that there's, as I recall, there's something to the effect of that there's no political solution. And what we need is preachers preaching the hot gospel. Now, what he could mean two things. I think he probably means the latter, but he could mean one, that there's simply never, ever going to be a political solution. It's just preaching the gospel. I know I don't think that's what he affirms. The second thing he could believe is that the way things are now, you can't find a political solution. You essentially need revival. And I can respect that view. The first one I would disagree with, I'll just say, I'm not ascribing that view to him, but I would disagree with that view because we need outward order. Just like in the family life, if you're going to have a well-ordered family, you need some kind of rules and regulation, patterns and habits, some identification, mutual love, and that all requires an order. A lot of the things that you do in your family, you do kind of by second nature. But that's because you've, through authority and also interaction, you've developed rules and customs of conduct within your own household. And that's why it goes well. There's also rules, too. If someone violates this or that, like a child disrespects their mother, the father would step in and say, you do not disrespect your mother. So there are rules and sort of regulations. The same thing with society. To have a good, solid Christian society, you have to have interactions as Christians. You have to have customs that are Christians. You have to have worship. You have to orient your life around worship. You also have rules that regulate Christian conduct, not only human conduct, just basic human stuff, but also Christian things. And so there has to be a political life. We should not think of revivalism and revival as a way to escape politics. Even among Christians, among fellow brothers, you're going to have disagreements. I think there's legitimate disagreements over, everything from tax policy to healthcare policy to foreign policy. I mean, we could have a huge debate over foreign policy and at the same time worship together on Sunday in bonds of unity. So there's always going to be politics. And I mean, you just take Protestantism today with its variety of denominations, the fact of the matter is if we have a society in which the principal part is going to be Anglicans, Presbyterians, and others who would affirm like a Sabbatarianism, they're probably going to want, and I would hope, to assert a Sabbath laws for Sunday. There are many Baptists who don't like that. You can affirm that they are brothers in Christ. They don't like the idea you'd have regulation on Sunday, but you have to do politics. And if you have the power and it's possible to enact that without too much trouble, of course, you don't want to overthrow the Commonwealth for a law that would not achieve the end you're seeking. Laws should seek certain ends. And if they fail to achieve those ends, then you should not enact those laws. Nevertheless, you're never going to escape politics. There's always going to be political questions. There's always going to be disagreement. There's always going to be people who are butthurt because they lost. That's just how politics works. And you can't count on a sort of revival to eliminate that. At the same time, there's always going to be dissenting heretical sects, and you have to adjudicate, and you have to deliberate upon how to deal with those. And usually, typically, as I would say, toleration is the best policy within certain limits. Okay. So anyway, you're never going to escape politics. You're never going to escape politics. And we have to acknowledge that. But at the same time, we should think of politics as less about, I mean, this is the complicated thing. You should think of politics as in itself, seeing what's possible at the moment, pretty much regardless of a sort of outward obvious show of revival. So you can have kind of nominally Christian, culturally Christian people and achieve great political things because they assent to the doctrines, they assent to Christian truth, and so they can assent to the politics, the associated politics. So you don't need necessarily a thorough revival in which hearts are regenerated. Now, in the long run, I get the critique that in the long run, you would need regenerated hearts in order to sustain that order, but it's not absolutely necessary. And in the end, politics is about consent. It's about legitimacy. It's less so about a majority of people exercising true faith in their hearts. Okay, so again, you can have a very culturally Christian place that can have actually very thoroughly Christian laws. So we've seen this throughout history. The point being is not it's not that like they're off. There should be like the spiritual side of it. There should be the work of ministers to convert hearts. The civil magistrates should have in their mind that one of, and perhaps the principal end of their authority and their work in the world is to direct people to eternal life, without ministering the word and sacraments, but still doing that. At the same time, magistrates, when they see the situation on the ground, they're not concerned so much in itself with checking to see if everyone's hearts are pure or if they're actually saved, but given the conditions and the characteristics of the people, can they enact these good laws? And in places where there is nominal faith, but there is assent to Christian politics, that would actually be a good thing for those people because then they would have enacted laws that would direct them to spiritual life, to actual spiritual heavenly truth. So if you have a nominally Christian society and they assent to the doctrines, but they're not pious in themselves, in their hearts, they can assent to a Sabbath law. And if they assent to the Sabbath law, then you can enact that law, which would then order them to worship on Sunday. I mean, I'm not saying force them to attend a church service, but if they can't do anything else on Sunday, they can sit around, I guess, and watch television. But at the very least, they would know that day for their community is set aside for the worship of God and the contemplation of spiritual things, and to avoid the worldly work and worldly efforts. Okay, so the point being is that you should look apart from like waiting. You don't wait for revival. The politician, the statesman, civil magistrate looks at the situation on the ground and says, "What can I achieve given the circumstances, the characteristics of the people?" And they enact the best possible laws to direct people to their temporal and their eternal good. All right, so I don't think we should not have a political theology of revivalism. We should not have, our Christian politics should not wait on revival. And in our situation today, we have different levels of jurisdiction. States have jurisdiction, federal government has jurisdiction. There are a lot of states that have really strong Christian majorities. And you see this within the pro-life movement in different states. you can tell, with a few exceptions, you can tell that the conservative, more Christian states have more restrictive abortion laws. Whereas the ones that are not a Christian state do not have the abortion laws. The point being is that we can actually achieve a lot in politics now because we have the federal system. States can achieve a lot. But again, you cannot escape politics. The fact of the matter is, you might get a total abortion ban by just 52% because you have a lot of women, even, you know, allegedly Christian women who want abortion, or you have, of course, just liberals who want abortion. You're going to make them unhappy, but you're going to say, look them in the eyes, and you're going to say, no, the human child sacrifice will stop. And so you enact the law, make them very unhappy, and that's politics. And it's always going to be that way. Now, you'd hope that more and more people would realize that it is an evil, and so they would no longer affirm that, and you would convince them through other means, through education, through other means. Nevertheless, you cannot escape the politics of it, and we have to be assertive enough to say no. And if we're assertive, like I think most Christians who are anti-abortion are assertive enough to know, hey, we should enact laws that restrict abortion, then why not for other things as well? Why not for other things that are damaging to society? And I'm not just the low-hanging fruit of transgenderism, but what about also anti-Christian bias within institutions? Why not more than that? Why not have Christian instruction in institutions, or assume Christian things in institutions, invocations in before government events? Now, there's all sorts of things you can do to recognize that you are a Christian state. So if you're assertive in one thing, why not other things? So the overall point being is this, is that we can within, because of the federalist system within the United States, we can enact a lot of good things. We just have to be assertive to do it and not be afraid of politics. Okay, let's not be afraid of politics. What is politics? Politics is the ordering of our social life in ways that conduce to good. And you order, primarily in politics, you order through law, which means you have to deliberate upon the proper law given the circumstances, and then you have to enact it, and you have to promulgate it, and you have to enforce it. That's the political. Now, behind that is the fact that God instituted politics. So this is one of the terrifying and honorable things in politics, is that you wield a sword that God has instituted for the good of people. In a way, you're like a mediator. You're a stand-in for God on earth. You know, not as that you are God, not that you deserve worship, but you have this power that God has granted to human beings that is a kind of divine power to order man to his good. And you have to do that with prudence. You have to do that with effectiveness, not simply, let's just enact a law that destroys everything because it's good. No, you have to do it. It has to be an effective law. That is, it has to produce good. And that is politics. That's why God has instituted it. So we should not be afraid of politics. It's very odd. It's very odd that you have Christians who want non-Christians to have power over Christians because they don't trust fellow Christians with that power. It's a very odd. It's one thing to say I don't trust non-Christians, but then to say I trust non-Christians over Christians with power is very, very strange. It would be make more consistent to say you trust no one with power. The problem is, unless you're an anarchist, someone's got to have the power. someone's got to have the power, and you would think that overall it'd be better to have Christians rather than non-Christians in power. Okay. Anyway, that is the discussion. That's basically what I have to say about politics. I think I covered both, right? The one was escaping politics. Yeah. So to summarize, yeah, we should not use political theology or rivalism to escape politics. And two, we should recognize that in our situation, there are ways that legislatures at the state level and governors can enact Christian laws. But I do agree, though, that there needs to be a recognition of the heritage of faith. I think that we in this country, as Christians, we kind of underestimate, because we're always looking for the people who are most faithful in attending church. I think we underestimate that even among nominal Christians, just to the extent to which there is support for a idea of a Christian America. And these people, not only are they a mission field, a call for them to be faithful, they claim to be Christian many times. In many cases, they've been baptized. So they are a mission field. At the same time, in terms of politics, they are people who would support Christian things and Christian movements. And so they are this sort of mission field in terms of politics as well. And we underestimate what politics can do even with people who are nominal or culturally Christians. So I think we should not underestimate what we can accomplish. Of course, we need to do more than just shout and scream. We need to actually work with people. We need to work with where they're at. It's not a seeker sensitive thing. It's just the fact that most of you, if you're Christian nationalists, you've probably moved into it from something else. So you know, by your own experience, the difficulty of moving from one thing to another, even if it's kind of a natural, I feel like it's been a natural progression for me for the most part. But still, it takes that little seed, you know, planted that kind of grows, and it's a process. It's a process. This is not politics, and changing people's political views is not like, you know, an immediate conversion from being a, you know, a low estate drug addict to suddenly Christian. You know, that's not it. So we need to know where people are at, and we need to work with them and where they're at. And keeping in mind that it's largely the conservative movement over the last 20, 30 years that has engineered their mind to think a certain way. They've engineered their minds to think a certain way. And also, just from their own life experience, secularism is the norm. It is the norm for our society. They've grown up in the norm. They've grown up not experiencing Bible being read in schools, or prayer over intercoms, or most people being Christian in their institutions and it being kind of assumed. To the contrary, they were raised in a secular environment with highly, usually diverse peoples, or at the very least, an emphasis on diversity, how diversity is strength and all that. So you have to then come alongside them, and you have to kind of slowly bring people over. And some people are kind of too far gone, but a lot of people who are conservative, they just simply don't know how to get to Christian political order from their thinking about our world today. They think in terms of very universal, like America is a melting pot, or it's a salad bowl, or they think America is just designed from the beginning to be this kind of multi-faith project, and it's an experiment. And because, you know, they've been listening to people like Mark Levin and these other guys who will talk like this, because it's very much in their interest to have a very universalistic conception of society, instead of having one that was actually Christian and more particular. So you have to come alongside them and bring them over. I keep going down rabbit trails, but one of the things is that when you look at kind of the landscape of people either on our side or on right-wing politics, one of the reasons why, like, the no enemy to the right, why it's appealing to me, is that you have to recognize that there are different people doing different things along the spectrum, but the spectrum as a whole is actually good overall for the movement. Even on the extremes, the extreme people should look at the less extreme people, if you want to put it in those those terms as benefiting in a way the extreme. So this is why I just don't think we should criticize too much the moderate voice, or at least we should kind of see how everyone is playing their part in all this. All right. Well, I could just keep on talking, but I wanted to keep this to about 30 minutes. We're at 35 minutes. I appreciate listening. If you want to support me, you guys should know where it should be down below. Again, thank you, and next time.
Went down to that river, washed my sins away, praying, 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 praying for another day. I went down to that river, washed my sins for free. The devil's on the other bank, staring back at me. I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man.